KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Now we're going to review the news of the week. No, the year. We'll see. We'll see how it goes with our panel of experts. Now you guys are experts. Knut Berger writes the Mossback column at crossgut.com. He's author of Pugetopolis, Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Steve.
May I say, because people can't see, that you hurt your back. And so last week and this week you're standing.
Yeah, I feel like Stephen A. Douglas, the little giant.
Well, because we're all sitting, right? And you're standing. I think that you have come up with a way that people could maybe get decisions made.
Seattle will do what I command.
Imagine if Congress just had one guy standing and everybody else was sitting.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. Good to see you. We are sitting.
Yes, sitting and a little intimidated by the standing.
David Horsey, though, who's taller than a lot of us, is political cartoonist and columnist for the LA Times. You guys are almost.
I was going to say he's taller. He's as tall as I am sitting down.
I don't have to stand up to be on his level.
What?
That's nice. Whatever that means.
Before I ask you about the stories. Since we just spent, and I know you haven't thought about it, so if you have nothing, say, I got nothing, Steve. But is there a piece of music that has been running around in your brains or a song that means something for this year?
Well, I'm not sure if it means anything for this year, but I watched a clip last night of Led Zeppelin getting its Kennedy Center honors, and they have the medals and the big black tie gala and everything. And they played this great film narrated by Jack Black about the history of Led Zeppelin. And the song that they didn't play that keeps going through my head and has been off and on all year is Whole Lotta Love by Led Zeppelin.
Because of what we've done in this state this year? Or?
Well, now we have marriage equality. Love is legal now.
Yeah, love is legal. Love is finally any song
finally
for you.
Legal.
I've got a couple of bands that are stuck in my brain just because I've been writing to them for a lot of the year, and I think I have to shake it up in 2013. But Beach House, I don't know if you've heard of them, but I've done a lot of writing to them this year, and also Hey Marseille.
Oh yeah,
to calm things down.
By the way, you mean that you've been writing while you've been listening to the music, that you've been stalking them with your letters,
fan letters. Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I've been writing while listening to them.
Wow, whoever
guys,
thought that
about
Eli?
I hope you do respond to my letters, please, soon.
Music to win a Pulitzer too. I like it.
Very nice. Yeah, why not?
You got two Pulitzer guys here.
How about you?
Yeah. Well. Somehow I missed that question, but I just sitting here, really old songs come to mind. Times they're changing, and I won't get fooled again. I mean, this is a year of political surprises and change, and maybe not just a sea change, but an ocean change in who the electorate is. So
maybe.
I don't know.
In terms of the electorate.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, politics will drag on in a slow little way, but. It's a different world than we thought it was at the start of this year.
Yeah, don't threaten people in America with their voting rights, and maybe in Egypt with their revolution. We'll still see about that. What was the most memorable story or issue for you this year, David Horsey? That was the question. We sent you three very bolded them right at the top.
I did my homework, and I don't know if this will surprise people or not, but for me the big story of the year was climate change. And it was not one story. It was a number of events, big events that were big news stories, and starting with the drought and the wildfires in the Midwest and West last summer, some crazy storms and a rash of tornadoes in the East and the South, and then of course Superstorm Sandy in the Northeast just. Finally grabbed everyone's attention, and people actually started talking about climate change. And add to that a pretty significant story here in the Northwest with ocean acidification, which has a lot to do with CO2, which of course has to do with climate change. All of this stuff is sort of coming together, and it seems to me that people at least started saying, you know, I guess things are different than it used to be. I don't know if it's going to make any difference politically or in policy for a while, but at least we know what the future is going to be like, and it's a bit daunting.
That was on my list, too. The deniers seem to have been quieted this year. What about you?
Well, I was just going to say, in response to that one, really depressing downside of that, I saw a poll the other day that says fewer Americans believe they can actually do anything about climate change. So just in time for us to accept that it's real, a lot of more people have kind of a fatalistic attitude about it, which is too bad.
I wonder if then that behooves all of us to figure out if that's really an acceptable notion or not, a notion we should be living with or not, you know, for the next few years.
Right. Well, yeah, the alternative is unacceptable. So I think that alone could steer people in a different direction.
And I'd sort of pair that thought with another big story through the year was the oil boom in North Dakota and in Canada. That is, you know, in the fracking that's going on at a monumental pace. That is totally the opposite of probably what we should be doing in any way if we're serious about global warming. And I have a hard time seeing that stopping.
And every media outlet, I was listening to NPR this morning, it was another kind of booster story about how, you know, Eastern Montana's joining in the boom now there's more to come. And yet there's never that line that says, oh, by the way, more fossil fuels, or the argument that we can't do it too soon, can't do it too quickly because it'll hurt the economy.
Well, you're already seeing one of the most immediate response to climate change is the land grabs or sea grabs that various countries are involved with because of the desire to get access to more fossil fuels. So you have the nations in the Arctic are jockeying and vying up there with their claims. And then just this last week, you had in the British Antarctic, they named a big chunk of the British Antarctica Queen Elizabeth Land in recognition of her Diamond Jubilee. The Argentinians went ballistic because Argentina and Chile have a competing claim in part of what is now Queen Elizabeth Land. And you know that the relevance of all this has a lot more to do with what might be under all that Antarctic ice as opposed to what's on top of it.
Oh, man.
And, of course, we saw some protests here in Seattle this year with the I think it was the Shell oil drilling rig that was supposed to go up to Alaska and drill under the loosened rules and then had some trouble in Bellingham, which kind of confirmed what the environmentalists were saying, that this thing wasn't ready to be safe up in the Arctic. And then we also see some fallout of all the things that we're talking about with the coal train issue.
Yes. I mean, is that directly related, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is coal that's coming from that roughly the same area. Obviously, coal is different than oil in terms of the way you extract it and just what it is. But it's the same basic issue. Do we want to be digging this stuff out of the ground, trundling it across several states, through a lot of cities in Washington, through Seattle, with these mile-and-a-half-long trains up to, I think, 10 times a day potentially that are going to deliver coal to China, which is going to burn it up and contribute to climate change.
What's been the biggest story for you this year, Eli?
You know, it may feel a little predictable, but I think it's true. I think the biggest story of the year is President Obama's reelection. Remember how long this year people thought this was not going to happen or that could easily not happen. How tense that race was. And you just think about how much hinges on that decision that the American people made just a month ago. I can't see how that's not the most important thing that happened this year. I also think it is the election in general is, in a way, the most over-covered story of this year.
So that was going to be my next question. The election in general, most over-covered?
Yeah, and that's less a problem with the media, I think, with the length of our election season. But we just saw once again that we do not need these, you know, 11-month-long or really 2-year-long presidential election campaigns. They becomes such a emotional drain and a financial drain and a drain of people's attention spans.
That's why you need salsa music. You know, that was my choice because I felt that way. And so I was finding myself listening to salsa music throughout the year just to like shake
just
it all loose.
You out of it.
You know, I was. We've been looking back at the year. We're going to do a two-hour year in review on Monday of like 4 minutes from different segments. And so what can I use to for us to understand what the news cycle was, but to look at our write-ups every week and see what we were talking about? And Herman Cain dropped out in like January or something. I mean, he was like one of the biggest stories of the campaign, and that was a year ago almost.
Yeah.
Too long.
What's your biggest story of the year?
I agree with Eli about the re-election of Barack Obama, I think, is the biggest story. It goes partly to the point that David made, which was a different profile of the electorate than was expected, and also kind of a lot of soul searching among pollsters and others about how to see what's going on. So I think nationally that was a huge story. In terms of locally, in terms of the Pacific Northwest or Washington State, I think it's marriage equality and pot legalization. I think those two things are real sea changes culturally. And it is a little bit like global warming, you know, where it's a really slow process until it suddenly speeds up. You know, you hit a critical mass. Right. I think culturally that happened with gay marriage. You saw major politicians, the president, the governor, Gregoire, shift positions. The fact that it passed. I mean, a lot of people thought putting it to a referendum was going to defeat it.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we were talking about when it happened. That's exactly the things we were saying.
There was a real concern about it passing. So I think it's both significant, as we discussed previously, as a civil rights piece of major civil rights legislation. But I also think it's interesting to see how the rest of the country covered what we did and the fact that it made such big news everywhere else, and I think as part of a shift that's going on, and we're a little bit, we're on the leading edge of that shift. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in the rest of the country now.
Do you think we will see more like this happen in the rest of the country? That great, the middle part where fracking and natural gas exploration and pipelines have been the issue. I mean, does it feel like we're leading edge, not off the cliff, but a leading edge?
Well. That's a very good question. Actually, this idea that with gay marriage, that there's been this slow process that suddenly has taken off, actually is a kind of a hopeful thing in terms of the global warming debate, because as Eli laid out, there are all these things coming together: the coal train, the fracking, the superstorm. That suddenly have it on people's minds, and maybe there will be the same sort of takeoff. Now the question is both, whether we're talking about climate change and oil policy and all that, or gay marriage, is will that shift happen in the middle of the country? Because in many ways, they certainly in gay marriage are going the other way. Is this going to be almost enlarge in the rift in this country between regions? I could see that happening too long before there's a total shift one way or the other.
Although one hopeful sign on that score in the election was in Iowa, one of the Supreme Court justices who had upheld, and I may mangle this a little bit, but had upheld Iowa's legalization of same-sex marriage, was facing basically a recall election, or he was up for election, and people thought, based on that theory that Horsey was putting forward, that he might go down, and in fact he was retained. So there, the cultural sea change, and a lot of the polling shows this, I think, is profound enough that it's bringing the middle part of the country along with it. It's a demographic change. It's a change coming about from people with really calcified retrograde attitudes, frankly dying off, and you can't stop that. And younger people just tend, polls keep showing this, to have more open views about gay marriage, and I think also in general pot legalization, and hopefully more progressive views on global warming as well.
All right. Well, on that note, I'll ask you about the least important stories or the most ridiculously covered stories. But since you end on that note, and we have crack producers, we'll go out with a little whole lot of love here under the bridge.
All right.
Nice work.
You need cool air, baby, I'm not fooling. I'm gonna send you back to school, way down inside. Honey, you need it. I'm gonna give you my love. I'm gonna give you my love. Oh. Want a whole lot of love. Want a whole lot of love. Want a whole lot of love. Want a whole lot of love.
Good morning, it's 10:20. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Later today, a conversation with author Joan Didion. Her 2005 book, The Year of Magical Thinking, won the National Book Award. It told the story of the death of her husband. Then 2 years later, she suffered the loss of her daughter. She details that experience in her latest book, Blue Nights. Joan Didion joins us this afternoon at 2:20.
Support for KUOW comes from the Museum of History and Industry. Celebrating their grand opening at Lake Union Park, Mohai will feature special performances, activities, and programs December 29th through January 3rd. More information and a full schedule of events online at mohai.org.
We have cloudy skies and 41 degrees in the University District. Forecast calls for clouds all day, chance of showers, the high inching up to 43. It's going to be cloudy tonight as well. Chance of showers, the low in the upper 30s. Clouds and showers expected tomorrow, the high in the low 40s.
I mean, I figured he had to be in sport, but he wasn't in sport.
Healthcare reform is much too important to build on an unconstitutional foundation.
So there's a host of actions we're going to take to work on and address bias in policing.
I think the Seattle fans deserve a basketball team.
Democrats said they think it's a good idea to drive the country off what economists are calling America's fiscal cliff.
It is time to give our loving gay and lesbian couples the right to a marriage license in Washington State.
While our journey has been long, we have picked ourselves up. We have fought our way back. And we know for the United States of America, the best is yet to come.
Little Macklemore giving us some cuts from the news of this year. We're reviewing the news of the week and the news of the year with Knute Berger, who's author of Pugetopolis, and also this year, A History of the Space Needle, because it was 50 this year. And David Horsey, Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist and columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And Eli Sanders, Pulitzer Prize-winning associate editor for The Stranger. We bow to you.
Yes, well, Newt should, since you're standing.
Standing. Yeah, well, my great honor was having a cocktail named after me at the Ivers.
Well,
so,
that's
you know, I put
better.
That up against your Pulitzers
totally
any day.
I think we tested that cocktail here in the studio.
That's right, we did. Mossback Nectar.
That was very nice. It was very nice.
That was this year.
Yeah.
Wow, so long ago.
By the way, my resolution for next year is, you know, we have Edward R. Murrow looking over our shoulder there in the studio. I'm putting John Stewart up on the other side of that closet.
Very good. Idea.
Yeah.
All right. So if we talked about some of the memorable stories or the issues of the year, I shall start with you. What was the least important issue we spent the most time talking about?
Benghazi. I think the Benghazi thing it became absurd. I mean, it was a terrible incident. We lost a U.S. ambassador. But this was a guy who went in knowingly into an extremely dangerous place in a country that has very little stability to try and solve problems. And, you know, he paid the ultimate price. But I think that the attempt to turn that into some kind of a scandal had, you know, just a blatant political purpose, which was both to damage Obama's reelection efforts, but also to damage Hillary Clinton, who may be running for president sometime in the future. And it managed to derail a nominee or potential nominee for Secretary of State. So I thought it just got way more than it was due in terms of the actual content.
Though, would you agree that it deserved to be investigated and looked at and figured out why security was
was in question? Absolutely, and which was done, which was done by the people who should do it. But I think it was the way the story then became about how the story was told, and trying to paint a much larger scandal picture where really a tragedy existed. And, you know, the State Department has had a complete independent investigation that's recommended major changes in the way they do things. It's totally appropriate.
And some of those changes happened already with people resigning.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think you're right, Skip. It was another example of Republicans just trying to find an easy issue to bash the president with. And it never went anywhere. They got, you know, one trophy from it by eliminating
Susan Rice.
Susan Rice. I was thinking Condoleezza, but but it never had the legs, and mostly because it was made up. And you can't just do that stuff. You know, things like Watergate, for instance. Now that actually happened.
What was your least covered? I mean, least important story that we spent too much time talking
well,
about?
Well, of course, my assignment for the year was to get obsessed with the election. And
from your editors, not from us.
Right.
Or your family.
Yes. and it sort of goes along with what Eli was saying, but I'd more particularly say the most over-covered story was the right wing in this country. Part of this was the natural skew coming from the fact there was no Democratic primary. So for the first half of the year, we were just obsessed with Republicans and the debate and the all the pleadings and pandering to the most extreme elements in the Republican Party. And I think that gave people a distorted sense of politics in the country about who's really who is going to shape this election. There was we talked a lot about the Tea Party about these billionaire guys contributing to PACs and all the attack ads. And as it turned out, all of that was a lot less effective than anyone expected, which actually takes me to the least covered one. Should I get to that one yet or save it?
Well, since you've done such a nice transition.
And that is the 20-something nerds in the back of the Obama campaign office in Chicago. Literally, this group of young guys and young women who actually had a grasp of the new electorate, which was the underreported story until it happened. They were able to identify these people. They understood, you know, this is different than it was 4 years ago or 10 years ago. And while the media and blowhards like Karl Rove and Dick Morris were all talking in the old terms of politics, these guys knew something was different.
I don't remember if it was Time magazine or the New York Times magazine, but there were pictures of the staff, the Obama staff. Yeah. Was that Time?
I think it was Time as part of the Person of the Year
and,
coverage.
Oh, that's right. And you sure saw that, who those people were and how important those people were and how organized. I don't know if the Mitt Romney campaign, which we find out today, Mitt Romney really didn't want to run for president. This week we found that out.
Right.
That's why he did it for 12 years.
Yeah, $45 million. But that was a pretty remarkable how they had – I mean, they changed the election, the way we're going to run elections from now on,
absolutely.
Right?
And there's been this assumption that, well, now the Republicans will do that. But first, the Republicans, as they showed in this campaign, have to get in touch with reality. I think some of them sensed that something was different. But rather than accept what polls were saying, they made up their own polls to make themselves feel better.
And well, the reality-based community did have a victory this year.
It was a victory.
Well, yeah, and they'd been too successful for too long at building their own reality and an alternate, unsupportable reality, and then winning off of it. I mean, think of the Bush years. There was so much of that. And I think they were clinging to the hope that they could continue that ad infinitum, and it's coming apart. It's obviously already come apart. If for underreported stories, for me, I would go local and point at the shootings that were happening in Seattle at an alarming rate at the beginning of the year, with an alarming uptick, and a sense that if this trend continued, and not just a sense, it was the fact, if this trend continued, we would have way more shootings in Seattle than we'd had in previous years, and something awful was happening. That was January, February, March. And then we kind of stopped hearing about these. There was a big response from McGinn, you know, with multi-point plans for how he was going to address this. But I think we all got distracted on the arena, on the election, on coal trains, on a lot of other things. And until this morning, looking at the Seattle Times, I hadn't really heard people talking about it. But they came back around with a good short story that I think, you know, is important, but there deserves to be a lot more coverage of this. Their story pointed out that for the entire year, we now have something like, I think, 26 shootings, which is not a great number, but relative to a lot of other major cities, it is a great number. And more importantly, relative to where we were last year and the years before, it's average. So what we were wondering at the beginning of the year, whether this was just a weird blip, you know, some sort of spike that would shoot back down as fast as it shot up. And it looks like that's what it was.
But there is also a question, and I don't know if this is – I see the Times asked that question in their reporting. Christine Claridge asked it. But there is that question of, did the response have an effect?
Right.
I mean, the Seattle Police Department said they were changing. There were these groups coming together. There was dialogue that had been opened. Maybe policymakers and the community were frightened enough to make some changes.
I think you can make a very good argument that it did have an effect. And of course, it's probably very hard to know. You can't, it's counterfactual. You know, you can't
yeah.
exactly show why something didn't happen. But if I were Mike McGinn and if I were running for reelection, as McGinn is, I would start to tell a story about how, you know, remember where we were at the beginning of this year. Remember how much concern we heard from this chair right next to me about safety in Seattle and the need.
You're pointing at the Seattle Times chair. We have a plaque on the back of the Seattle Times. I don't know how you ended up sitting in that chair,
I'm
David Horsley.
The need for more police. The
slightly
need for
dirty.
Police to get tougher. and you know, something happened. And McGinn, I think, would be well within his rights to say it was something that he directed.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if it continues. And then, you know, if their killings are down in 2013, then I think it does say something has shifted rather than just a random thing.
Well, and all the more reason, I think Eli's point is a great one, which is do the reporting, try to figure out whether those programs, whether the mayor declaring a homicide emergency in fact worked, because it is going to be critical to the arguments made in the mayoral campaign. Tim Burgess's really, so far, his entire reason for running is public safety and his experience in public safety. So is he going to be able to bring new ideas, or is the current guy effective?
And what you've started to sort of hear Burgess saying, or maybe I'm intuiting this, but I think what he's saying is, well, to the extent that things are safer in the city, it's because the mayor has adopted my common sense policing proposals, the ones that I've been talking about for a long time. So yeah. I think that's probably where Burgess will maneuver to, but it's not as potent.
That's not a winning argument in the end. It's sort of like, yeah, what he said, but I made it, you know,
I made it
better.
I said it first.
Yeah.
You said you had a Goldilocks. You had a just right coverage story.
Goldilocks. That's the opposite of the type of locks that I have. I do have a just right story, although it could have been a little bit more. But remember the Supreme Court race that we had here between Justice Stephen Gonzalez and Bruce Danielson? Gonzalez, the first Mexican American justice ever appointed in Washington State, appointed to fill a vacancy in 2011, I think, by Gregoire, then had to stand for re-election in 2012. And at the last minute, this guy whose main qualification, as far as anyone could tell, for the Supreme Court was that he had an Anglo-sounding name, Bruce Danielson, jumped into the race to challenge a guy with a very non-Anglo-sounding name, Stephen Gonzalez. And in the voting results, you could see a very clear pattern, and this was statistically proven, of racially polarized voting in Washington State that really hurt Gonzalez. And Gonzalez was aware that this would probably happen, and he was alarmed about the potential for Danielson to win votes just based on his name. You know, when the Bar Association in his own county said he was totally unqualified to be on the Supreme Court. And in fact, Danielson won something like 400,000 votes, you know, an election that only had, I don't know, something over a million votes cast. Danielson didn't win, and it's in part because, in addition to Gonzalez sounding this alarm, the local media started to sound this alarm in Seattle, and then people picked up on it and said, hey, there's a guy running for Supreme Court who is spectacularly unqualified, and because of latent racial bias in the state, it's possible he could win, and these way down ballot Supreme Court elections are incredibly important. Never mind, this is hugely embarrassing, this prospect that we would put someone on the Supreme Court based on, you know, prejudice and lack of information. A lack of information, by the way, that comes in part from the fact that due to budget cuts, we don't even have a voter's guide that gets mailed out to every voting citizen anymore in Washington State, which is another problem this and the coverage of it brought up. But I say just right in terms of coverage because ultimately Gonzalez won, and hopefully in the next legislative session people will do something about this lack of a voter's guide, which, as Gonzalez says, undermines our democracy.
And also, and just to follow up on that, the idea of what the Latino electorate will do and how they will respond to that story and gerrymandering, the other issues, that's an ongoing story. And that, because of that issue, became sort of a critical issue that I know a lot of people are going to be looking at in the next year, yeah, and the years ahead.
There's that lawsuit going on in Yakima right now over whether Latinos are allowed fair representation, I guess, you know, through the political system, and challenges to that. But overall, there's this current of, you know, increasing force for Latinos in elections in this state, which is good.
Did you have a least covered story?
I did. I was just amazed that Bob Woodward of the Washington Post had a great scoop on a tape of a Fox producer talking to then General Petraeus, and she was reportedly delivering an offer from Roger Ailes and presumably Rupert Murdoch, yes, to convince Petraeus to bail on the Obama administration and run against Obama in 2012, and promising money and all kinds of stuff. And Bob Woodward got a tape of this interview and published it in the Washington Post. Weirdly, the Washington Post, they did put it on the front page of the website, but in the print edition, they put it on the society page as a kind of gossip.
Society page.
As a kind of a gossip story. And this thing has just gone nowhere. And if you read the transcript, if you read the thing, it really is amazing. I mean, Roger Ailes basically said, well, I never told her to say that stuff, you know, and the producer basically said, oh, it was just a joke. Yeah, right. It was a joke. Nothing serious going on here. But I think that, you know, in the context of what Murdoch has done in Britain with his papers and the bribery scandals and the political influence stuff, I mean, here was a caught red-handed. And that story just died. And Carl Bernstein, Bob Woodward's former partner in Watergate coverage, came out lambasting the media about a week or two ago, saying, this story is huge. What happened? And I totally agree. It just I mean, Benghazi's a story and this is not. just amazing to me.
Well, I wonder if some of the reason it was played where it was in the Post, whether it was just in Washington, it was like no big surprise.
Yeah, right.
But the reason it didn't get more coverage in the broader media was simply the continuing nervousness about writing about ourselves, when in fact Fox News isn't ourselves. I mean,
what's the part of the story that he reportedly offered that the Murdoch empire would be behind him and support him 100%.
Yes. And now, it may be that part of why it died was Petraeus had gone on to the CIA and then was involved in his own personal sex scandal.
Yeah.
And
by the time the story broke.
Yes. And in fact, had resigned, you know, from the CIA.
Well,
at that point,
somebody said it at the time the story stuck up its small head briefly. if NBC had done something like this, it would be a huge right. scandal on the right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, Rush Limbaugh would blow his top. But
Ed
somehow
Schultz,
it just doesn't work the other way.
It literally, I mean, they were literally able to laugh it off.
Yeah.
It was just a joke. We were just funny.
Right, right.
In terms of less behind-the-scenes Murdoch maneuverings, this year featured a lot of important tweets from Rupert Murdoch. Remember when he, on his Twitter feed, said the Romney campaign basically wasn't ready for prime time, and that was part of Republicans kind of continuing to throw up their hands and give up on Romney's potential? And then after Newtown, which I think is another one of the major stories of this year, although I think it might oddly become one of the most important stories, or hopefully of 2013.
Next year, yeah.
In terms of the reaction, if there is a reaction and we don't just all get, collective amnesia when the clock strikes midnight on December 31st. But after Newtown, Rupert Murdoch was saying on his Twitter feed, which, again, everyone in politics watches, that the U.S. should have more sensible gun control laws. And there was a lot of reaction on Twitter. Well, is Fox then going to push for this? But just the fact of him tweeting this kind of sends a signal to the Fox empire that this is where their boss is.
By the way, is it known that he's actually the guy putting the tweets out?
Yes. It's not a fake. It's not fake Rupert Murdoch.
But he's in control of it. It's like maybe aides, maybe him, but it's his
yeah,
Twitter.
He's never yeah. denied the legitimacy of these tweets. And in fact, he uses them,
To fire people.
Yeah, right. You didn't see my Twitter feed? Why did you show up today?
All right. We'll take a break and then we will get more thoughts about some news that's breaking this week. By the way, we have a resolution going into this new year. We would like to get 4,000 friends on our Facebook page. I know that I think The Stranger probably has 150 million,
but
we just want 4,000 friends because it's nice. It's a satisfying even number, and then we could communicate with more of you in the new year. So find us on Facebook, Weekday on KUOW. Give us a like. You'll find some photos of all our guests. You'll find recommended books by Nancy Pearl, previews. We try to put pictures of people in the studio up on the air. We'll take a picture of you standing. I think we'll do that. Put that up on the Facebook page. And like us and get us over the 4,000 mark. This is Weekday.
Beck does not intend to ever play or record his latest batch of songs. He wants you to do it for him.
Hopefully the songs can be taken in different directions and people will take liberties with them.
I'm Jackie Leiden. Beck releases 20 new songs only as sheet music. Next time on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's Weekend All Things Considered tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from TakeWinterByStorm.org. When there's snow and ice on the roads, to keep safe, stay home. If driving is a must, travel with a shovel, a bag of sand, chains, and warm clothing. To use transit, no snow routes, but expect delays. More tips and checklists at TakeWinterByStorm.org.
We have a mix of clouds and a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 43 degrees right now in the University District. Forecast calls for clouds all day, chance of showers, the high right around 43. Same for tonight, clouds, chance of rain, the low in the upper 30s.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's, where doctors and nurses provided more than $103 million in uncompensated care to children and families in the region last year, thanks to a generous community. Information at seattlechildrens.org.
This is Weekday on KUOW. We're reviewing the news of the week with Knut Berger. We did not check Crosscut's Facebook numbers. We'll check. But The Stranger, 30,000 likes.
On Facebook.
On Facebook.
30,000 followers.
30,000 followers. Yeah. Just to our less than 4,000. We'll have to get up to that.
You'll get that.
And Horsey, you have what?
16,000.
Wow. If it's a race, I think you and I may be losing.
Well, no, I'm losing for sure. See there.
That's why we have that chair, David, because you have the most. That chair fell. Sorry.
I think I'm bringing up the rear at 1,000.
It'll do it again.
Yeah. Sorry about that. We have a chair that it's a trick chair, and if you have too many Facebook followers, it doesn't support it.
Wait. When you get a little seniority, they'll let you stand.
Yeah.
We're reviewing the news of the week. Any last takes on the things, the most memorable, least important stories we should have been talking about?
Least remembered, most important in Washington State, I think, is this two-thirds majority decision that is churning through the state Supreme Court and will have a huge impact on state budgeting if it ever.
Yeah, I was going to say, if
rides.
The Supreme Court ever gives us that ruling.
Right. But hope, I mean, this is quite a hope. But hopefully they would see the benefit in delivering their ruling before the legislative session starts on January 14th, because what they rule will determine what kind of majority you need in Olympia for raising revenue or even sometimes closing tax loopholes. So hopefully we will see that soon. And that will be, if there is a change in legislative policy directed by the court, that will be a sea change in Washington state politics.
You know, the other thing that's been interesting, and we'll see how it plays out, is because it's all about the Supreme Court ruling on education funding, that was the debate throughout the governor's race. We'll see how they actually how that manifests itself. Of course, that's going to depend on who's in charge in the Senate, but I mean in the legislature, in the House. But we'll see overall what happens. I was supposed to ask you, here we are just a few days from going off the fiscal cliff. Starbucks decided they were going to put messages on their coffee cups to urge legislators to do something. Is there what message should Starbucks baristas in D.C. put on their cup for congressmen?
Wow.
If they're cynical realists, it should say Geronimo.
The problem
or
is
jump.
The congressmen don't happen to be in Washington right now.
That's true. Yeah. You know, that's true.
They forgot to come back.
They're all watching movies.
Nobody told them there was a crisis. Watching just... It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes, but they're weeping about what happened to Potter.
What?
Yeah, right. If you watch that movie over Christmas, which I did, I do every year, and I cry like a baby. You know, you look at that and you think, what Republican congressman goes home and watches that movie and thinks that Potter
absolutely
is the good guy?
Potter,
maybe that's what Obama should have encouraged them to do instead of going home. Yeah. And I think he said, have some eggnog, enjoy your families, reflect, come back and get something done.
Come back and play the Jimmy Stewart role.
Yeah.
Come on, guys.
But no, Potter is the soul of the Republican Party these days. And I say that, you know, that sounds pejorative, but I mean, everything he says in it is, you know, is
right on the script.
It is the script of the party.
The reason I said jump a moment ago when you were asking what, you know, advice should be given to congressmen in D.C. is that, you know, like Patty Murray has been saying, I think the best thing that could happen, and it seems a lot of people in D.C. do actually based on their inaction, is that we go over the cliff, which again is not a cliff, but more of a long downslope. And we get a few days into this post-cliff jump era, and then we fix the problem, which will be easier politically to fix because instead of raising taxes, we will be lowering taxes.
Do you suppose that the Republican Tea Party wing has made that calculation as well?
Oh.
And that's why they're so adamant about not making any changes.
NBC actually reported that last night, that they are... The Republicans are talking about that, and it seems it seems so ridiculous that let's just wait till the new year comes in, and then we can say we lowered taxes rather than raised them by doing exactly the same thing. It's just absurd theater, but Washington is the theater of the absurd. And I think part of it probably is too, as Patty Murray pointed out. The cliff analogy has been wrong all along. It's not something that's going to happen immediately. And so there will be some action. And this is sort of why right after the election, I just want to say I predicted the fiscal cliff would come before anybody did anything, partly because everyone knew it's not really a cliff, partly because there simply isn't the sort of political will or organization in Washington, especially in the House Republican Caucus, to make it happen. And because the Democrats knew if they waited, they'd get kind of what they wanted anyhow. All the Bush-era tax cuts were going to go away. And that was always their strength. It's like, well, we'll deal with you guys now, but if you don't want to, we'll just wait, and then we'll actually get this new revenue, and then what?
All the talk about Patty Murray was reminding me of another noticed, but I think in total under-noticed story of the year, which is Patty Murray's increasing clout in D.C. Remember, she ran the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which people at the beginning of the year did not think was going to be able to succeed in holding the Senate for Democrats. It was an awful assignment to be given. You know, hold this really stinking bag of limited possibility. and Patty Murray managed to hold the Senate for the Democrats, or at least the Senate was held under her direction, so she can claim some credit for that. And then she's been a leader on the fiscal cliff strategizing. She continues to rise in prominence and clout in D.C. and just be a kind of increasingly go-to person for the smart way forward.
Hmm. Just in terms of the election for just a minute, just two quick stories on that. Did you all read the Boston Globe story, the story behind Mitt Romney's loss in the presidential campaign to President Obama? He wanted to be president less than anyone I've met in my life, Tag Romney told the paper. Assuming he's met a lot of people who want to be right. President. He had no desire to run. If he could have found someone else to take his place, he would have been ecstatic to step aside. He's a very private person who loves his family deeply and wants to be with them. He has deep faith in God and he loves his country, but he doesn't love the attention.
That seems so utterly absurd. I can't figure out what he's saying or why. If he truly believes this, why would a guy run? You know, it didn't just run this time. He ran last time, which means for about 12 years he's been running for
right.
president.
And he never stopped.
And if you really didn't want to do that, you could not do it.
Yeah,
there were other people.
There wasn't exactly a clamor, you know, on the right for Romney to run, that he wasn't drafted. There were plenty of other people who wanted to run instead of him. So this idea that he had to, where does that come
yeah.
from?
What, when,
no, this, it's sour grapes through a surrogate.
Yeah.
And I remember the corporate executive Bill Simon ran for the U.S. Senate years ago, conservative, and he lost. And, you know, and somebody asked him about, you know, what it felt like to he was such a corporate winner. What did it feel like losing? And he said, well, I never wanted to be one of 100 anything in my life, you know, and this was after he lost.
Right.
So it's like they've tried out every excuse.
Yeah.
And this is just embarrassing.
It's a weird one coming from his son. And the only way I kind of can understand what's in his mind is people have talked about how the Romneys had a sense of destiny. And part of the reason they fooled themselves into thinking they, you know, even on election night, that the numbers don't count, we're going to win in the end, that it's sort of like he was on a mission from God, like the Blues Brothers. And quite literally, in terms of his faith, his family may have believed this is going to happen because God wants it. These are true believing people. So maybe in that sense, he didn't really want to do it, but he had to do it because the Lord told him to, or Angel Moroni or somebody.
Continuing with the Department of trying to make sense of this weird statement from Tag Romney, isn't it Tag or one of the other Romney sons who's believed to have political ambitions and could be a good political candidate? And so maybe this is a way, or maybe they think this is a way of interrupting a future narrative that would be, here comes the son of Mitt Romney, scion of an unbroken chain of hyper-ambitious losers. His grandfather ran for president and lost. His father ran for president and lost. Now here he comes. And instead they can say, my father actually did it as a service to the Republican Party reluctantly, you know, and that's how I come to you as well.
All right. One other goofy story that I just thought was interesting that Jason put up here. This was from the Washington Post. The day after Labor Day, just as the campaign season was entering its final frenzy, Freedom Works, the Washington-based Tea Party organization, went into free fall. Richard K. Army, the group's chairman, former House Majority Leader, a man who sat in a very interesting yellow suit in our green room a few years back, walked into the group's Capitol Hill offices with his wife, Susan, and an aide holstering a handgun at his waist. The aim was to seize control of the group and expel Army's enemies. The gun-wielding assistant escorted Freedom Works' top two employees off the premises, while Army suspended several others who broke down in sobs at the news. The coup lasted all of 6 days. By September 10th, Army was gone with a promise of $8 million, and the five ousted employees were back. Now, that's the way you run a political campaign or political process, right?
Wow.
Well, and if you read the story, where did that $5 million come from? From one of the behind-the-scenes donors.
Yeah, one of his donors. And of course,
one in the supposedly grassroots operation.
I mean, that's really what this story points out, and is that there's so many good Americans out there who have crazy ideas who have been just fooled by the whole Tea Party scam. At least part of it is a huge scam by people like Dick Armey and other major operators with lots of money who've just marshaled it for their own political purposes and their financial purposes. And wow, but it just does show the power of bringing a handgun in.
Well, I was going to say, I think this proves that all those political foundations should have armed guards,
exactly.
Just like our schools.
That's right.
Wow, I think you did just make that argument. Man.
And since he's standing up, you have to listen to
him. That's right.
Wow. All right. In terms of what's going to happen next week, we won't do the whole next year because we'll do that next year, next week. But in terms of what's going to happen in the legislature, how are you assessing what's going to happen in terms of control of the Washington State Legislature and the Senate?
Well, I think it's going to go to the coalition in the Senate of Republicans and two Democrats. It seems like it's really just a question of when that happens.
Brad Owen will broker some kind
right,
of deal.
Whether, well, yeah, and the deal he's going to broker is trying to get it done sooner as opposed to later. I mean, his view is that unless they come to an agreement about how to make this transfer, technically the Democrats are in charge until the transfer takes place. And if it has to be a floor vote, it won't be until mid-January. And that steals maybe a week of work that could get done. So it's really a matter of kind of how the transfer takes place. And there are all these, you know, little details that are, you know, about who gets which office and when and moving their stuff around. I mean, it's a big deal in terms of the workings at the Capitol, even if the rest of us don't really care who has which office. It does make a difference down there to staffers and other people who have to, you know, they're either working on the budget or they're carrying boxes to another building.
I've heard a few people make the argument that this will be better for Jay Inslee because there'll be more friction is good for a difficult budget. And this is going to be a difficult budget. I don't know if you've been covering this at all or looking at it very much, David, but do you have any thoughts?
Well, yeah.
In Eli,
too? I mean, a couple of things. One, I wonder if Ed Murray now regrets he didn't just
say he was running for mayor.
running for mayor because he said, well, you know, I still have to run this next session of the legislature. Apparently won't be. and I think this sort of odd relationship reminds me way back in the dark ages of my career, I actually covered the legislature when there was an even split in the House and there were co-speakers. And this isn't necessarily a bad thing politically because you had these two conservative Democrats who were going to be problematic anyway. So this sort of forces them to take responsibility. And for a governor, a smart governor can take advantage of this sort of oddball kind of situation because it's not going to be a stable political situation in the Senate.
I think that's interesting what you said about Ed Murray. If he wishes he had just committed 100% to the mayor's race. What do you think, Eli?
I do wonder about that, although I think, you know, the fundraising total that Murray turned in the other day makes him probably not worry as much. I mean, he's going to go into that fundraising freeze during the legislative session, but he already has in the bank $120,000 after just a few days of fundraising, which is a huge amount. In terms of the legislative session, it actually doesn't start next week. I don't think it's not.
No, we have a couple of weeks. Yeah,
got a couple of weeks to hand wring and wrangle over this. And maybe it's politically good for Inslee to have some friction. Maybe it helps give him a rationale for, you know, re-election down the road if the friction maintains for 4 years. Well, you got to send me back because these guys keep thwarting what I really want to do. But in terms of the losers, I mean, it's the people of Washington. We have a broken budget. The Supreme Court agrees in terms of our ability to fund basic education, which is a basic need. and we're not going to be able to fix it with Republicans in control of the Senate.
All right. I want to thank all our Friday panelists, by the way, in 2012. So Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, David Horsey, also Lynn Varner, Bruce Ramsey, C.R. Douglas, Eric C. Barnett, Peter Jackson, Essex Porter, Tim Egan, Just Fight. You guys, we know that, you know, this show is possible because you guys contribute your time, and I appreciate it. So thank you for that. Have an excellent new year.
You too, Steve.
And we'll talk about more issues in a week.
Good morning, it's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Bedrooms & More, family-owned in Wallingford on Northeast 45th Street for over 30 years, a local resource for natural and organic mattresses with an extensive selection of natural bedding, pillows, and toppers. Online at bedroomsandmore.com.
This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.